used in high school's classrooms, and then compared the footage with film taken of mouth-breathing sea creatures, the similarities would be striking. "What's going on, Mr. Scott?" Stacy coaxes. I don't admire many things about Stacy, but I have to admit, it takes some ovaries to talk to your physics teacher like he's a puppy. Mr. Scott doesn't seem to mind, though. "Today, I assign my world-famous physics photography project." The class groans again. Projects are the worst. "You'll each be assigned a partner." More groaning. Scratch what I said before. Group projects are the worst. "Oh, come on," Mr. Scott says, smiling. "My students always love this project."
"What do we take photos of?"
Stacy asks as she twirls her pencil between her fingers.
"Patience, Stacy. I'm about to explain that," he says.
And for the first time ever, I sense a bit of irritation in his voice. I wonder if Mr. Scott dreamed of being a physics teacher when he was our age. I doubt it. I bet he thought he'd land a fancy job at NASA or something. Poor guy. I can think of few fates worse than teaching the young minds of Langston, Kentucky. Mr. Scott continues.
"You are going to take 5 photographs in the real world that represent the principles of the conservation of energy theory. The photographs must be related to a theme of your choice."
"Theme?"
Tyler Bowen interrupts.
"Yes, theme," Mr. Scott says.
"In the past, I've had students use basketball as a theme. All of the photos were taken at a Langston High game. Other past themes have been amusement parks, dogs."
"Like shopping could be a theme?"
Tanya Lee volunteers. Mr. Scott winces and then quickly returns to his neutral facial expression.
"In theory, you could take all your photos at the mall."
Tyler Bowen raises his hand. This is new, him raising his hand instead of simply blurting out whatever's on his mind.
"Yes,"
Mr. Scott points at him.
"Do we have to take the photos ourselves, or can we just pull them off the internet?"
Another wince.
"Good question. You must take the photographs. A big part of your grade is going to be..."
"That's not fair," Stacy protests. "This isn't photography class."
Stacy isn't as good as Georgia at masking her whines as valid arguments, but I'd still give her an A for effort.
"You aren't going to be graded on the quality of the photographs, per se," Mr. Scott says quickly, "but I'm going to expect that you'll..."
He trails off.
"Hold on. I might as well pass out the worksheet that better explains the project before I continue rambling."
The class mutters, a mixture of groans and sighs. Mr. Scott's face reddens, and he fumbles with the worksheets.
"Does someone want to help me pass them out?"
No volunteers.
"A cell?"
he says, in a pleading voice. Sure. I stand up from my desk, even though I would rather eat staples than interact with my classmates. I don't make eye contact with anyone as I pass out the worksheets. No one seems that interested in looking at me, either. Every time I reach someone's desk, I sense the person stiffening their back, holding their breath, willing me to go away. Part of me wants to shout that they don't have to be afraid of me, but another part of me, the bigger part of me, holds it in, because I'm not so sure. Once I'm back at my desk, Mr. Scott continues explaining the project. He tells us that he expects us to mount our photographs on white parchment paper and then organize the photographs into a booklet. Each photograph is expected to have a detailed written explanation under it, describing the history of the principle and the formulas that correspond to it. We'll be graded on the clarity of our photographs, our descriptions, and our explanations of the physics principles involved. We'll also earn points for how well organized our booklet is and the creativity of our theme. Additionally, if we don't have access to a digital camera, we can borrow one from the library. Mr. Scott is leaving little room for excuses.
So, now all that's left is to choose partners,
he says, clasping his hands together.
I think the most fair thing to do is pull names out of a hat.
As predicted, the class erupts with protests.
That's totally not fair, Stacy says.
Yeah, echoes Tanya. We should get to choose our own partners, especially since our grade depends on them. Mr. Scott scratches the back of his neck, his eyes twitching.
In the years that I let people choose their own partners, I got unoriginal themes and uninspired photographs. In years where the partners were chosen at random, I got much more creative work. I think it has to do with pushing students out of their comfort zone.
The class continues to argue with him, even though we all write our names on small sheets of notebook paper and hand them to him. He grabs the Cincinnati Reds cap he has on his desk and puts all the names inside it. As he calls out the pairings, the groans and sighs become louder. I clench my teeth and wish I'd been smart enough not to hand in my name. Maybe then I would have gotten to work alone. Even better, I wouldn't have to listen to my partner throw the world's biggest fit once they find out they're stuck with me.
Asel Saran, Mr. Scott announces as he pulls my name out of the hat.
The class goes silent.
Your partner will be Tyler Bowen, Mr. Scott says cheerfully, completely oblivious to my social leprosy.
Oh, God. Stacy says. She reaches out to pat his shoulder. I'm so sorry, Ty. Tyler's face darkens like someone just murdered his mother. I guess, given my family history, I shouldn't joke about that. I almost feel bad for Tyler. I know that any association with me is bad news for him socially. But the thing is, our project is due on April 10th, so... in the end, it doesn't matter. I'll be gone before we have to turn it in. Saturday, March 16th. 22 days left. The last 10 minutes of my shift at TMC are always the slowest. I debate calling the next person on my log, but that would mean I actually care about being a good employee, which I don't. Instead, I play around on smooth passages. I read more of the postings in the Suicide Partners section. It's strange how some people post multiple times. I wonder if they didn't like the people who responded to them, and then I wonder if someone other than me responded to Roman. Did he pick me over someone else? The thought makes my stomach flip in a way I'm not used to. Mostly because never in my life have I been picked when there was another alternative. Though, if I'm being completely honest with myself, Roman probably didn't have any other choices. Willis, Kentucky is the middle of nowhere. Lucky for him, Langston is only 15 minutes west of nowhere.
I told you to stop checking dating websites when you're at work,
Laura grumbles. Why do you care anyway? I quickly minimize the window before she can get a better look at the website. She picks at her chipped pink nail polish.
I don't care, though I have to tell you, I think you're only going to find straight-up weirdos on there.
She has no idea how right she is. Thanks for the advice. I do my best to maintain a straight face, but I can't. Laura shakes her head.
Don't blame me when your computer gets a virus.
She points at my screen. I'll make sure to inform Mr. Palmer that the straight-up weirdo website was all me. I give her a wink before I pick up the phone, trying not to laugh, and dial the next number on my list. Earl Gorges, who lives on Rowan Hill Drive.
Hello?
A deep voice answers the phone. May I please speak to Mr. Earl Gorges?
Speaking,
the voice says. Hi, Mr. Gorges. This is Azel Saran. I'm calling from Tucker's Marketing Concepts on behalf of Fit and Active Foods. I'd like to ask you a few questions.
Go to hell,
he says, and hangs up the phone. I turn to Laura. That man just told me to go to hell. This time it's her turn to laugh. I decide to take the long way when I drive to pick up Roman. My hands start to tremble as I pull onto Tanner Lane. I've avoided this street as much as possible since everything with my dad happened. Tanner Lane sits on the outskirts of town, home only to the recreational center and a few run-down shops. As I drive down the road, I let myself glance to the left. And then I see it, my dad's old convenience store. The shabby gray cement building doesn't look any different now that it's abandoned, which says more about its past state than its current one. The town keeps talking about tearing it down. Apparently, some developer bought it and plans to turn it into one of those fancy gas stations where you can treat yourself to a slushy of any color, buy a hot pizza, and fill up your tank. All you could get at Dad's old store was a candy bar, a cup of coffee, and the newspaper. I know I should be eager for it to be torn down, hungry to see the memory crumble. Maybe if the scene of the crime no longer exists, people will start to forget. But I know that's not true. And even if it were, I don't want to see the building go. For better or worse, it's my childhood. I stare at the building and remember sitting inside, behind the counter with my dad. We'd share a Snickers bar and listen to Bach. He'd tell me how, when he was younger, he used to fantasize about learning how to play the piano. He said that once he made enough money at his store, he was going to pay for me to take piano lessons. He was going to send me to a fancy music camp. I guess things didn't exactly go the way he planned. The parking lot is empty. I pull my car up to the building and turn off the engine. I step outside and run my hands over the familiar concrete blocks. I walk around on the front curb and search for the place where I pressed my palms in the wet cement of the sidewalk when I was 10. When Dad first discovered what I'd done, his eyes blazed with anger, and the vein in his forehead bulged. But then he stared at the tiny handprints and back at me and finally burst out laughing. He flung me over his shoulder and said,
I guess it's fine, Zelly. This way everyone will know the place belongs to you.
I squeeze my eyes shut and put my hands into the old imprint. They're too big to fit now, but it still feels like more of a fit than anywhere else in the world does. I tilt my head toward the sky and slowly open my eyes. The sky is gray and still, like it's holding its breath. I hold my breath, too, and wait for the pressure building in my throat to fade. It doesn't. I miss you, Dad, I whisper as I turn my eyes back to the cement curb. I know I shouldn't, but I do. My phone beeps, and I see a message from Roman. I tell him I'm on my way and jump back into the car. When I reach Frozen Robot's house, I text him to come outside. I don't want to have to face his mom. But when the door opens, I see Mrs. Franklin standing there. She walks toward my car at a brisk pace. I take a deep breath and roll down the window.
Azel, she says, her voice tight. I'm so glad you're here.
It doesn't sound like it. I nod at her because I'm not sure what I'm supposed to say to that.
Roman didn't get out of bed yesterday and refused to go to school, but he just told me that he's planning to go out with you. Is that right?
She squints at me, like she's trying to determine what my allure is. Poor woman. She has no idea that it's not me that holds the appeal. It's death. I nod again.
Yeah,
We're going to hang out. I try to keep my voice neutral, afraid that even the slightest shake in my voice will give our true plan away, the real reason for our hangout.
Where?
She puts her hands on her hips. I sink farther into my car's seat. I hadn't prepared for an interrogation. I'm fumbling around for an answer when Roman comes up behind his mom.
We're going to the playground.
Her gaze darts from me to him and back again. A worried look crosses her face and she pinches her lips. Then she smiles slowly, but it's a weak one.
Are you going to play basketball?
I look to Roman for the answer. His shoulders are hunched, as if he can barely stand to hold himself up, like he's uncomfortable with his own height. But he's one of those people who can never be invisible, even if they want to be.
Yeah, I'm going to teach Azelle how to shoot.
He slowly gestures toward me, his hands clumsy and sluggish. I wonder if he used to talk with his hands, but now he's out of practice.
You're looking at the next basketball superstar.
I force myself to smile and can only imagine how awfully fake it looks.
He claimed he could teach a cat to shoot, so I gave him a harder student. Me.
Mrs. Franklin laughs, but I still sense a bit of hesitance.
Okay, well, you kids have fun, but Roman...
She puts her hand on his shoulder, and her pink lacquered fingernails glint in the glow of my car's headlights.
Will you call me if you're going to be out late?
Yeah, no problem, Mom.
He gives her a weak hug, and I look away as she runs her fingers through his short, buzzed hair. She waves at us as she walks back into the house. Roman slides into the passenger seat. And we sit for a few moments in silence.
Nice to see you too, I say.
I told you to stop making jokes.
That wasn't a joke. I turn back on the engine.
So are we really going to hang out at the playground?
I use his same words from the other day. Hang out sounds so much less morbid than where should we go to plan our joint death?
Sure. The old playground sounds good.
He stares out the window and seems even more distant than he was when I first met him. I steer my car down his street and take a left turn onto Main. You forget I'm not from Willis. I don't know what you mean by the old playground. Maybe he's the type of person who turns his lies into truths in his head. Like just because he told his friends we met at the old playground, somehow the universe made that true.
Keep going this way, and then take a right turn onto Possum Run.
Only in Willis, Kentucky would that be the name of a street.
You had me at Possum Run, I say.
He glares at me.
Okay, okay. I'll be serious.
You're freaking me out,
he says.
Why?
With the jokes. You seem serious about this whole thing, but then whenever you start to talk about it, you're all light-hearted.
I let out my laugh, the same one that comes out whenever I'm talking to Laura. It's high-pitched and strangled.
See?
Sorry. I laugh when I get nervous.
Why are you nervous?
I take the right turn onto Possum Run.
Because you're interrogating me about my motives.
Besides, I once read that a side effect of depression is an overwhelming desire to make stupid jokes. He frowns.
I'm serious.
I don't think that's true.
Look it up.
Okay, I will.
He crosses his arms over his chest and looks out the window.
So are you going to tell me or what?
Tell you what? My car bumps over a pothole on Possum Run.
Why you want to do it?
I see the playground on the left side of the street. The old playground apparently consists of a rusted swing set, a cracked basketball court complete with a metal chain basket, and three rotting picnic tables. It looks like it used to have a sandbox, but at some point, I guess, the sand got replaced with gravel. Soda cans and plastic potato chip bags are littered across the muddy grass. In some ways, the playground feels more like a graveyard, like it's a decrepit testament to faded memories, better times. Maybe that's why Frozen Robot likes it so much. I park the car and look over at him. His knees are folded up and knocking against the dashboard, but he doesn't seem to mind. His hazel eyes are wide as he studies the playground. "You haven't told me why you want to. I didn't know that we were planning on sharing with one another," I say. My lungs constrict, a warning not to reveal any information that I'm later going to regret having shared. He opens the door and gets out of the car. I stay seated for a few seconds longer and squeeze my eyes shut. I know it contradicts the whole idea of having a suicide partner, but a giant part of me doesn't want to tell Frozen Robot my reasons. I don't want him to start looking at me the way the other kids at my school do, like I'm a ticking time bomb. I like that Roman thinks he and I are similar. I like having someone relate to me. I don't want to ruin that. And worse, with his connection to Brian Jackson, I don't think he'd take what my dad did lightly. Sure, he might not still be close to Brian, but it all feels very uncomfortable, considering my dad is responsible for the tragedy that's haunted Brian's family, the very reason his brother didn't make it to the Olympics. No way I can tell Roman about my reasons. I'm not going to risk him bailing on me. All he needs to know is that I'm ready to die. That should be enough. He taps at my window. I get out of the car and lean against it.
"Sorry," he says. "I can be an asshole sometimes. Ever since."
He trails off and cups his hand over his eyes as he gazes up at the sky. The sun is almost set, so I don't know why he's worried about shading his eyes. Maybe it's just a habit. It's funny, the things we do out of habit. "Ever since," I prompt him. He walks over to one of the picnic tables and sits on top of it. I take a seat next to him and breathe in the scent of damp, decaying wood. The sky is a hazy indigo. March sunsets are always like that in Kentucky. It's like the sky has too much moisture to produce any color that isn't some variation of blue.
"Ever since she died."
"Who died?" I don't miss a beat before I ask. It's probably not polite, but I figure none of the normal social rules apply to my and Frozen Robot's relationship.
"My sister. My little sister. She was only 9 years old."
I bite the skin around my thumbnail and stare at Roman's profile. He's pulled his knees to his chin, folding himself up like a camp chair. That's young. For a brief moment, I think of Mike. He's 9, almost 10.
"Too young."
17 is young, I offer.
"Are you trying to talk me out of doing this now?"
"No. I was just making a point that I don't think you have to die just because she did. There's like..." He interrupts me.
"She's dead because of me."
His voice is a low growl, and I scoot away from him. "What do you mean?" His shoulders tremble as he lets out a loud exhale.
"I was babysitting her one night. But I wasn't really babysitting her, you know?"
I don't know, but I give him a slight nod, urging him to go on.
"My girlfriend was over, and Madison, that was my little sister's name."
He takes a few shallow breaths, and I'm terrified that he's about to start crying. I never know what to do when people cry. I haven't cried since I was 10. I think it's because the black slug sucks up any of my potential tears. Roman continues.
Madison wanted to take a bath, and I told her that was fine. But you see, Madison used to have seizures. Like, really bad seizures. So she wasn't really supposed to take baths alone.
Uh-huh, I grunt, taking a move from Laura's playbook.
But I wanted to, you know, with Kelly.
Wait, I say. Was Kelly our waitress at the root beer stand? He shakes his head.
No, that was Susie.
But Travis implied that you guys used to date.
We used to date, like, forever ago.
You've had multiple girlfriends? I try not to gape at him.
That's seriously your question right now?
He tosses his hands up in the air.
I'm telling you this story and that's your question?
I shrug and go back to chewing on my thumbnail. I kick at the bottom leg of the picnic table. It shakes, and for a second, it looks like it might fall off. Go on.
Aren't you going to say sorry?
Doesn't it kind of not mean anything anymore? That word, especially if you're asking me to say it? He draws his eyebrows together like he's actually contemplating whether or not sorry has any power anymore. For an instant, I feel a little bit bad and say, "You're right, I'm sorry."
Yeah, okay.
He goes back to his camp chair pose.
So, anyway, I told Maddie she could take a bath because I was an idiot. And all I could think was that her taking a bath would give Kelly and me 15 minutes of uninterrupted time. So Kelly and I went to my room, and I turned on my music really loud so Maddie wouldn't hear us, you know?
I really don't know. I'm kind of amazed that Frozen Robot seems to think I've ever had a sex life.
So Kelly and I...
He gives me an awkward look and dangles his hands at his sides. I fill in the nonverbal clues.
And then I come out of the bedroom and go check on Maddie and...
His voice cracks, and I hear him choke back a sob.
I found my sister dead in the bathtub. She drowned while having a seizure. If she screamed for me, I didn't hear it because I was too busy fooling around with my stupid girlfriend.
His story makes me feel like someone stabbed me in the chest with a shovel. I suck in my breath as I try to process what he just confessed to me. I know I should say something sympathetic, something kind and comforting, but the black slug inside of me has eaten every possible kind or comforting or sympathetic thing I've ever thought of to say. So instead, I blurt, "But what does that have to do with driving? Like I thought you'd been in some terrible car accident or something." He jerks his head up, and I see that the rims of his eyes are red. He jumps off the table.
"You know what? Forget it. I thought I could do this with you, as weird and screwed up as you are, but I don't think so."
"Roman, please." I stand up on the table's bench, glancing down at him. "That's not fair. I don't know what you expect from me." He runs his hand through his buzzed hair, refusing to look at me. He stares at the muddy ground.
"I expect you not to make fun of me."
"Make fun of you? How am I making fun of you? You're the one who just called me screwed up."
"You don't think you're screwed up?"
"I know I'm screwed up." He slow claps.
"Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. There's at least one thing we agree on."
I jump down and stand beside him. I resist the urge to grab his arm. "Come on. We can still do this. I just didn't know what to say. I'm not a psychiatrist."
"Obviously,"
he says, and shakes his head at me. Slowly, a crooked smile appears on his lips. "You wanted me to feel sorry for you?" I walk over to the swing set. I grip the smooth chain links and sit down on the paint-chipped metal seat. I start pumping my legs, straining for as much height as I can get. Maybe, if I pump hard enough, I'll fly into the air and my kinetic energy will project me out of this universe. Unlikely, but a girl can dream. He doesn't answer me, so I say, I don't feel sorry for anyone.
Why? Because no one's life could be worse than yours?
He takes a seat on the swing next to mine, but he doesn't make any effort to move. His swing drifts under his weight, but he doesn't pump his legs. No, I say. I just figured the whole world feels sorry for you. You obviously aren't looking for someone to do what everyone else already does. I'm getting higher and higher, and I feel the swing set creak.
Be careful, he says.
Why? I'm not thinking about being careful. I'm thinking about one last push of letting go, of flying, and of falling.
You aren't allowed to die without me,
he whispers. Saturday, March 16th. 22 days left. Roman asks me to drive up to Crestville Point. Crestville Point is a park that sits on these huge hills above the Ohio River. The edge of the park is made up of rocky cliffs, and Roman has it in his head that it's the perfect place to die. I'm not so convinced. What if the impact doesn't kill us? I ask. We could be alive for at least an hour in the water, whimpering and in agonizing, blinding pain. It could take a long time for us to actually die. I don't want a long, painful death. That's not what I signed up for.
You are seriously twisted. Do you know that?
He says as he walks along the trail. We're trying to find the easiest way to access the cliffs. The park rangers try to make it difficult, mostly because they don't want teenagers to cliff dive for fun because they'll probably die. I just hope the chance of death is more than probably. I've been thinking about this longer than 11 months, I tell him. Sure, I'm twisted, but I also have more insight.
Don't give me that 11 months crap. I want this just as much as you do. Besides, you have no idea what it's like to live with this kind of guilt.
Roman's voice is cold, and he doesn't stop charging up the hill. He's practically jogging, and I'm struggling to keep up with him. You're right, I don't. But you don't know shit about me either. I barely spit out the sentence. I lean over and grab my side, panting heavily. I really should get out more. The cool grass tickles my ankles, sneaking into the open space of skin between where my jeans should meet my sneakers. My jeans are a little too short for me, but I'd rather swallow glass than go shopping with Mom in Georgia. I figure I can make it another few weeks without new pants.
I don't know anything about you, because you won't tell me anything, he says.
He doesn't seem to be winded at all. Damn him. I motion toward a grass clearing. I bet if we cut through here, we'll get closer to the water. He follows me through the grass. It's hard to see where we're going since it's now dark, and I wonder if in some ironic twist of fate we'll soar over the cliff without even realizing it, like the universe's final joke. You can't plan your death, even when you try. The grass clearing slowly turns back into forest. Dark, thick tree trunks surround us, and our shoes crunch over leaves and twigs. I almost trip on a bumpy root, and Roman steadies me. The thing about the Ohio River is it doesn't make a noticeable sound. No frothing or burbling, but I can still tell when we're getting closer. I can smell and practically taste the dank, musty water. The ground turns from a muddy forest floor to gravelly stone. We've arrived at the edge. We both stare out at the river, The only sound around us is a few warbling birds.
I don't get why you won't tell me anything,
he finally says. Why are you so curious? Does it even matter why I want to die?
Kind of,
he says. Why?
Because if it's stupid, I'd try to talk you out of it.
I laugh. No, you wouldn't.
Yes, I would.
You wouldn't because then you'd lose your ride, remember? You don't have the ability to get away from Mommy Dearest. You never did explain that, by the way. Even though the sun has set, he does that thing again where he cups his hands over his eyes as he looks out at the sky. We're standing close enough together that I can see the holes in the collar of his black T-shirt. His collarbone is sharp and visible beneath his skin. He's thinner than I realized. He catches me staring at him and takes a few steps away from me, creating space between us.
After Maddie died, I was sent to therapy. Lots of therapy. The doctors suggested to my parents that I lose my driving privileges because they were worried about my ability to stay present in the moment. They also suggested that I never be left alone, unsupervised. Apparently, being completely alone tends to make people more depressed. But as far as I can tell, how I feel about Maddie's death doesn't change whether I'm alone or not.
Therapy. Right after my dad went away, my school made me visit with the counselor 3 times a week, but the meetings weren't productive. I just sat there, hummed a classical tune, and stared at her excessive collection of potted plants. Eventually, she gave up on me.
What?
He says. I must have made a face. Nothing. I once got sent to a counselor. So I found it funny that therapy didn't work for you either.
Funny?
Not funny. Ironic.
Not sure that's the right use of ironic, but you seem to be smarter than me, so I'll trust you.
You'll trust me? He doesn't answer. He sits down by the edge and leans his whole body back. He cradles his head with his hands and fans out his elbows. I sit beside him. I don't lie down, but I pull my knees to my chin. Do you want to die in the water because that's how she died? He closes his eyes and gives me a small nod.
It only seems fair.
We can do it here if you want. I'm just nervous about it. I unwrap my knees and reach out to feel the ground. The rocks are rough on the palm of my hand.
I'm pretty sure it's a normal reaction to feel nervous.
I exhale loudly. I'm not nervous about the act of it.
Oh, you're such a hard ass that the idea of jumping off this cliff doesn't make you the least bit nervous?
Roman props himself up on his side so he can look directly at me. Okay, maybe I'm a little scared, but I'm more scared about what comes next. He goes back to lying flat on his back.
You mean, like, what happens to us when we're dead?
I pick up some of the gravel and let it sift through my fingers. Don't you ever think about that? What if this isn't the end, and we just go on to a place even worse than this one? He sits up and grabs a stone. He tosses it over the cliff's edge. It seems to disappear before it hits the water, too small to even make a splash.
Any place has to be better than this one.
But do you think it's really possible to die? His face hardens, his jaw muscle tightens, and his eyes glow like they're burning. I wonder if Frozen Robot used to look different before Maddie died. With his chestnut-colored hair and clear skin and strong jaw, he's definitely classically good-looking. You know, good-looking in an obvious way. Like he's the type of boy who gets cast in back-to-school shopping commercials. You could see him anywhere, and you'd know from looking at his face that he was popular in high school. Yes, Roman is one of those people. But the longer I look at him, the more I start to realize there's something different about him from the Tyler Bowens and Todd Robertsons of my world. I take back what I said when I first met him. Frozen Robot does have a frozen quality. All of his movements and facial expressions have a tension to them, like he was carved out of stone and locked in a chamber of ice and recently brought back to life. I don't know how to describe it, but the more I stare at him, the more I see his grief wrapped around him like shackles he can never take off. I try to imagine him without the grief, without the heaviness, without the frozenness, but it's hard to see him as anything other than desperately sad. Yes, he looks like someone who was designed to be popular and successful, but he also looks like someone who was made to wear grief. He wears it well.
How can you even ask that?
His voice brings me back to reality.
Obviously, it's possible to die. Maddie died. She's dead. She's gone.
I shrug, rubbing my palms over the gravel. The stone's edges tear at my skin. I've been thinking a lot about the energy of the universe. And if energy can't ever be created or destroyed, only transferred, what do you think happens to people's energy once they die? He shakes his head, stands up, and walks farther away from me, closer to the edge. I follow him. Looking down at the river, I try to imagine what it will feel like when I hit the water. The Ohio River moves so slowly. There's no churning or sputtering, only a lazy flow. Maybe the water will hug me tight, squeezing all the air from my lungs. Maybe it will feel like I'm being rocked to sleep. Maybe I'll get pulled under and everything will turn black and it will be like dreaming. Maybe.
You can definitely die.
He repeats his argument from earlier.
Maddie's dead. I don't see her energy anywhere.
Just because you can't see it doesn't mean her energy is gone. His hands jump at his sides. He picks up another rock and throws it over the edge.
You have to stop talking to me about this. It freaks me out.
It freaks me out, too, I say softly.
I need to think that when we die, we're going to be dead. I can't think about anything else.
Okay. I agree to stop talking about it, but that doesn't mean I can stop thinking about it. We both go back to looking at the river in silence. We go back to imagining our watery deaths. Monday, March 18th. 20 days left. Monday morning in my house is probably my least favorite time of the week. I can't ever sneak in an extra 15 minutes of sleep because Georgia always gets up extra early to root through her entire closet. God forbid she chooses the wrong outfit. Apparently, the statement you make on Monday is really important. According to Georgia, what you wear on Monday determines how the rest of your week will be. Like if you dress really nice and get tons of compliments, you'll pass your algebra quiz on Thursday. I don't really think polynomials have anything to do with wedges or skinny jeans, but Georgia is completely convinced. Good thing I wear a variation of the same thing every day. Gray striped long-sleeved t-shirt, black jeans, gray sneakers, so there's no chance of things ever being different for me.
Azelle, she hisses. Azelle, wake up!
Georgia, I groan and roll over on my side. I press my face farther into the pillow in hopes of drowning her out. I don't really care whether you wear your purple sweater dress or your red pencil skirt. I'm sure everyone will think you look beautiful either way. I hear the end of my bed creak. She starts poking me in the sides, and I squirm away from her, my limbs tangled in the sheets.
What the hell? Wake up!
She bounces back up and paces around the room.
Look out the window!
I rub my temples. I was planning on sleeping for at least another 15 minutes, 20 if I decided not to brush my hair. Sighing, I force myself out of bed. I stumble over to the small window that's positioned in the very middle of the back wall of our room. That window has been our dividing line for the last 3 years, left side for me, right side for Georgia. Her side is covered with pages she's ripped out of fashion magazines and pictures of her and friends and her collection of salt shakers. She has this strange obsession with unique salt shakers. Shakers shaped like owls, trucks, wolves. She finds them at thrift stores. My wall is empty.
Look,
she presses, pointing at the window. Outside, I see that the grass is blanketed with snow. I blink because the sun is out, and it makes our whole yard glisten. The snow is piled against the trunks of the oak trees. And from what I can see, it looks like we must have gotten at least 4 inches.
Isn't it amazing?
Georgia says, clapping behind me.
School is canceled.
It never snows in March, I say. It did once when we were little, remember? I remember. It was a good day. I couldn't have been older than 9. Georgia must have been 7 then, and Mike was 2. Dad drove me to spend the day over here because he still wanted to work at the store, hoping that he might get some extra foot traffic since all the kids would be out of school. That morning, Mom made us chocolate chip pancakes, and we spent the rest of the day building snowmen in the yard and sledding down the hill on Vine Street. We felt like a real family that day. I didn't feel like an interloper who only came to visit on weekends. That was a long time ago. It's silent for a few moments, me staring out the window at the fresh snow and Georgia watching me stare. Neither one of us knows how to talk to the other anymore. I think I'm going back to sleep, I say. That's what a snow day means now, not pancakes and snowmen, but extra hours in my bed, alone. I hear her make the verbal equivalent of a frown, a whiny snort.
Are you, like, still tired from Saturday night?
What?
You were out late, she says.
I flop back into my bed and pull the comforter over my face. I'm not going to talk about Roman with Georgia, not in a million years. She sits down at the end of my bed again.
Who are you with?
Do you have a boyfriend now or something? I can't help but laugh. If I have a boyfriend, his name is Death, and I'm pretty sure Roman is in love with him too. It's like a love triangle gone wrong. Or maybe it's a love triangle gone right. We both get the guy on April 7th. She huffs, and I feel the bed move as she gets up.
Fine, just laugh at me. I was only trying to talk to my big sister. Excuse me for making an effort.
Oh, now you want to talk to me? I feel the urge to laugh all over again. The irony of the whole thing. She's only interested in talking to me when a half foot of snow separates her from hanging out with her friends.
Half-sister, I correct her,
and for a second I feel a little guilty. Then the black slug comes to the rescue.
You're impossible, she says, and sighs.
If I didn't know her better, I'd say she was sad. She leans against the wall, her hand on the door handle.
So, you know, Mom made pancakes.
I hear the door slam as she leaves. A few seconds later, it opens again.
Oh, and so you know, Steve.
She says, Steve, in the exact same way I always do, stretching it out like it's a loose rubber band. There's an awkward pause, and then she continues. Yeah, Steve. He's at work. Sparkle didn't close the factory. You mean your dad, I correct her again. Your dad is at work. Yeah, my dad, the one you hate for no understandable reason, the one that gave you a home. That's it. I throw the comforter off me and sit up straight. How generous of him! And I don't hate him, Georgia. Oh, yeah? Well, you sure act like it. I'm tired of you spending every day feeling sorry for yourself just because of what your dad did. Newsflash, you aren't your dad, and you should stop blaming everyone else for what he did, yourself included. Tell that to everyone else, I think. I flash her a snarly frown, hoping she'll leave me in peace, but she stays. She stares at me for a while, her hands on her slender hips. I stare back at her, trying to figure out how we are even half sisters. With her fair skin and honey-colored hair and tiny nose, she looks like the prototypical Kentucky beauty pageant contestant. She's like the sun, and I'm like the bumpy, brooding moon. The only thing we have in common is our eyes. We both have Mom's dark, almond-shaped eyes. Right now, her hair is in a braid, and she's wearing boy boxers and an oversized Kentucky Wildcats t-shirt. I wonder if she's given up on her Monday rule. I'm about to comment on it, but before I do, she says, I just wish you weren't so sad all the time, Azelle. Me too, Georgia. Me too. I take a deep breath and get out of bed. I'll meet you downstairs for pancakes. Just let me brush my teeth. She smiles like I just told her she aced her algebra exam and skips out of our room. I don't think I've skipped since the last March snow day. I walk down the hall to the bathroom and squeeze some toothpaste onto my toothbrush. I take the toothbrush back to our room and scrub my teeth as I look out the window. I overhear Mom and Georgia and Mike talking in the kitchen. She's coming down soon, Georgia says. Oh, good, Mom says. I'm so glad you convinced her to get out of bed. The smell of maple syrup fills the entire house. I can hear Mike banging his fists on the kitchen table. Make sure you add extra chocolate chips, he says. Azelle loves chocolate chips. My heart swells, and I wait for the black slug to take the feeling away from me. But it doesn't. It lets me keep it. The swelling turns into a small, sharp ache. It's going to be harder to leave them than I realized. As I put on my slippers and pad down the stairs, I find myself wishing that every day were like this one. If every day were like this one, I don't think I'd be so eager to be gone. The problem is, March snow days are miracles. You can't live for miracles. Wednesday, March 20th. 18 days left. Tyler Bowen is waiting for me at the table in our school's library. I figured he would blow the whole thing off. But it looks like sometimes I can be wrong about people. Our school library is less like a library and more like a media center. It sits in the middle of our high school, a hollowed-out space that they filled with computers, tables, and flimsy plastic bookshelves. Recently, they've hung Brian Jackson banners on the back wall. They're the same ones that hang at TMC. I can't escape them.
Hey, George's sister, he says as I take a seat at the table.
You do know I have a name of my own, right? I unzip my backpack and pull out my physics notebook. Tyler's pale face flushes, making his freckles more prominent. What? I uncap my pen and tap it against the table.
I don't know how to pronounce your name.
I laugh and his face turns a deeper shade of red.
"It's not funny," he says, looking down at his shoes. "You have a strange name. Did your dad choose it?"
I blink, a bit stunned that he would actually willingly bring up my dad. "I think my mom picked it, but I'm not sure."
"So how do you say it?"
"Azel," I say. "Rhymes with gazelle." He squints with confusion, and so I add, "Azel."
"Got it, Azel,"
he says, overpronouncing it. But it's a start. "You seriously didn't know how to say my name?"
"I had an idea, but I wasn't sure. You know, it's hard to pronounce."
"Fair enough." I shrug as I realize I see myself in the same way Tyler Bowen does, as an unknown variable. "So should we get started?"
"Yeah, probably."
He runs his hand through his auburn hair. I wonder if he thinks that makes him look suave. "Any ideas for the project?" I nibble on the end of my pen, ensuring that I look decidedly not suave. Tyler doesn't answer me. He leans back in his chair and waves to one of his basketball buddies who just walked into the library. His friend shouts something at him, but gets shushed by Ms. Silver, the school librarian.
"Hey, give me a minute," Tyler asks.
"Sure." I watch him dash across the library to meet his friends. I can see them whispering to one another, motioning in my direction. Tyler shuffles his feet and shrugs. I imagine he's explaining that he was forced to work with me.
"See you later, man,"
I hear one of his friends say.
"Yeah, good luck,"
the other one adds. Tyler eventually walks toward me, but his pace is slow, like he's doing his best to show that this is a punishment, not a choice.
"Sorry about that."
I shrug. "No need to be sorry. Let's just get back to work."
"Sure thing, Azel."
"You don't have to say my name every time." I reach into my backpack and pull out my physics textbook. I let it fall on the table with a slam. "So do you have any good ideas for the theme of our project?"
"Theme?"
Tyler Bowen evidently doesn't pay much attention during class. "Yeah, a theme. Mr. Scott said our project has to center around one."
"Oh, that theme."
He stretches his long legs out.
"Why not basketball?"
I give him a blank stare. "Seriously?"
"Yes, seriously."
Tyler leans over the table toward me.
"Mr. Scott used it as one of the examples, so he clearly loves it as a theme."
"Or it's been done 100 times before. We should be creative." Then again, I don't know why I care about this project. Meeting with Tyler is a waste of my time. It's not like my grade on this matters. I'll be gone before we even turn it in. But I want to do a good job for Mr. Scott. Even if I'm not around to see his reaction to it, I want him to know I took his class seriously. I flip to a blank page in my notebook. I tap my pen against the paper, hoping to come up with an idea.
"What do you mean, creative?"
Tyler says the word like it's as foreign to him as my name. "Yeah, creative. Why don't we go to the zoo or something?" I jot down my idea. He makes a face.
"The zoo? That's like a place for little kids."
"Oh, come on. I bet you used to love it."
"When I was like 11, I did."
He touches his hair again. To his credit, his hair is shiny and soft-looking, and this fact obviously isn't lost on him. "The zoo is perfect," I continue. "There are so many photo opportunities, like the bats hanging upside down have potential energy, and maybe we could even photograph a lion eating raw meat and label it as an energy transfer."
"But the zoo is 1,000,000 hours away in Louisville. Can't we choose something easier?"
It's not like I can spell out the truth for Tyler. That I want to go to the zoo one last time before I die. That I'd love to see the lions bathing in the sun or the polar bears splashing around in their deep water pool. Frozen Robot would probably tell me I'm a flake to be thinking like this.